Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Laura Dave with us. She's the author of The First Husband. That's a novel. She is the author of The Dinner Party, The London is the Best City in America. She's contributed to the New York Times, the Huffington Post, Red Book, Glamour, Self, and NPR's All Things Considered. And let us say, Laura, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. The First Husband. Now, the plot in and of itself, and it's probably happened to so many people out there, you're in a relationship, you think everything's going good, and then all of a sudden, it's not going that good. What was it that stimulated you to put this kind of a story to pen?
You know, I was really interested in the question of how do we avoid living our life in reaction? How do we create a situation for ourselves where we're operating from a place of being proactively happy and proactively moving forward in our own lives? And so in order to do that, I wanted to start with a woman who found herself, as you just said, as many of us do, at the end of a relationship that she didn't want to end, and that sort of ended unceremoniously and in a surprising way for her. And in response, meeting and marrying someone that she barely knows, and sort of starting in that place of reaction, seeing where she ends up.
You know, interesting point. Possibly marrying somebody that she doesn't really know. There are so many people, instead of reaction, we'll call it rebound.
Exactly. It is. It's a form of rebounding for sure. And it's so funny because since my book came out, I keep getting notes from people and emails from people saying they ended up marrying someone on the rebound to very different results. I'd say it's about a 50-50 split that I get. Some people have found their happily ever after in that rebound, and some people said it was a really big mistake, which is very funny for me to see how many people really relate to the character of Annie in that way.
Well, there's got to be a lot of people that relate. You know, man or woman, it doesn't really matter. You know, you reverse the situation. It's same, no matter which way you look at it. The other side of it is reaction. How do you get someone, what a question, who knows if there's an answer to this, to not react, to be able to move through it very comfortably? Oh, you love somebody else? Well, have a nice life and maybe we'll go out to stay. It doesn't work that way.
Right. No, I don't think it does. And, you know, I spoke with a lot of relationship experts and marriage counselors while I was working on this book to try to get to the bottom of how do we find happiness with someone else? How do we find happiness again if that initial shot at it doesn't work out, like is so often the case? And how do we sort of move as gracefully as possible through the transitions within one relationship or from one relationship to another? And, you know, as many people as I spoke to, I got as many different answers. But one thing that really stuck with me that I thought was very smart was thinking about the idea of not just committing to the other person, but committing to the best version of yourself. And what that seems to mean, or my takeaway of that, is finding someone that makes you proud of the person you want to be. And often that creates a situation where you encourage those positive traits in yourself.
No, by the way, if you draw to you someone like that, then you don't really have to worry about someday you come home and the bags are packed. I mean that they're But there's a word that you use, which is, well, let's call it a term that you use, which is very interesting. Superstitious beliefs. And you were relating that to, you know, the Roman holiday, the unlucky film. But when you say superstitious beliefs, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that often, you know, we have these objects in our life that we think are going to bring us luck or bring us the opposite of luck. You know, for a lot of men, that can be something sports related. I have a friend who will wear the same shirt to every Phillies game of the season until they get into the playoffs, as an example, because he thinks that shirt's good luck. And, you know, you really, whether it's rational or not, you really hold on to those beliefs. And for Annie and the first husband, she has sort of the opposite belief. She thinks that this movie is really bringing bad things into her life, and that it's a really an idea that she can control the bad if she just doesn't give in to her love of this movie and watching it. And I really wanted to play with the idea that we really think that things outside of our control, that there are ways that we can control them, but really, more often than not, we have no control, especially over the things that matter most to us, and sort of letting go of that and letting go of the things that we think are dangerous is really a smart thing to do in order to ensure some sort of comfort and happiness moving forward.
You know, life in and of itself, it's a pathway. We've heard the cliche term that it's a journey, but it truly is. And the journey, really, the end result isn't really the end result. It's living it yourself. But you tied Annie in the travel column, checking out, to inspirational passages. Now, where was it that you tied into that? What did you see? What was that bright spot for you that caused you to interject this into the book?
Well, I really like the idea of travel as freedom, or thinking about travel as freedom. The reason that Annie calls her column Checking Out is that she has this idea that travel is like escape, which is, you know, often another word for freedom. You throw the shackles off, you see something new, you explore different aspects of the world and of yourself without limits. But I wanted to play with the idea that ultimately what she comes to understand is that sometimes the very things that we think are burdens actually make us the most free and make us the most safe, and we can explore the most in sort of the confines of what maybe would look like settling, what maybe would look like sitting still. So over the course of the book, she understands these columns to move in a different direction, that it's not really about always, you know, finding the furthest away mountain and, you know, escaping to it, but really sometimes it's about moving deeper within yourself and figuring out what it is that you really want and who's really going to help you get there.
And truly to understand what no and you can't means. I know somebody, which is very interesting, who was she was a great athlete, and the coach told her that she wasn't any good and that she shouldn't pursue it to be a professional and to leave it alone, and she would not take his advice, and she did everything she could do to become the best athlete she could in the field that she was in. So she went right to another coach. And, well, actually, she found the coach probably 2-3 months later. And this guy coached her, and everything was working well. And she ended up marrying the second coach.
Oh, my gosh. That's so funny.
Yeah. And had she not, and if the first coach had not told her that she wasn't any good, she'd never met her husband, who she's been married to for years and years and years now.
Mm-hmm, totally. And I think that that's a really, I mean, that's a great story. And I think it's a really important lesson that we can keep banging up the wrong tree, or we can find that if we are brave enough to figure out that something's not working, we don't have to struggle so hard with a new fit. We can find a fit that will really work for us and someone that will honor who we authentically are without trying to sort of change us or shift us. It can be scary to do that, but, you know, if she hadn't been brave enough, then she wouldn't have found happiness.
No, absolutely, no question about it. And she did what she did, and she wouldn't take no or you can't for an answer. Now, one of the other things which brings it up, a love story in and of itself, is this a love story, or is this a coming together story for an individual? What is the story?
You know, that's a really good question. I always, people keep emailing me, readers, which I love, and saying, I'm so surprised at who she picked and how the story ended up, and I won't ruin that, but what I often say is it really wasn't a story of Annie picking between these two men, the one that hurt her and the one that she marries in reaction and on the rebound, as you said, to that hurt. But it's really about which Annie is going to choose, the person that feels sort of insecure and isolated, or the person that does the hard and necessary work to become more engaged in her own life. And that, for me, was really the journey of the character in the first husband, and the two men were sort of the side story to that.
Yeah, now, what's bringing this up as I'm listening to you very closely, and really think about this question. Do you have to be in love with yourself first before you can be in love with someone else? How can you be in love with someone else if you don't recognize it within yourself?
You know, I think that's a really good question, and you know, in thinking about it, which is something I've spent a lot of time thinking about, sometimes if you're with the right person, that can, you know, a right person, that can help grow your self-love and help you feel more secure. But if you don't have enough sort of love and self-respect going in, that person isn't going to be someone that is attractive to you or interesting to you. You know, I think in ways that we're not even aware are happening, we pick our matches, we pick our emotional matches. And if we're at a point where we're very conflicted about ourselves, we're often going to pick someone who is also very conflicted about us. And so you really do have a responsibility if you want to find lasting love and find, you know, a love of a lifetime, to figure out how to love yourself over the course of your own lifetime in order to get there.
Well, Laura, you just said it, that there's the magic. You said find your emotional match. And if you deep down unconsciously think that you need to be beat up, that you're not good enough, or that whatever driving force is there that causes all the problems in your life, guess what you're going to find? That person.
Yeah.
That's going to prove everything you need to prove about yourself to you. And
right.
I really believe if people are going to get into relationships today, they need to clear themselves first. And then it'll come, you know, you'll draw to you who you can prove yourself right about yourself with.
I mean, what's interesting too is often we think we're picking brand new people. This person's not going to make me miserable in this way or that way. And really, until we do deal with ourselves or clear ourselves, as I really like what you just said, until we do that, we're going to pick the same person in different pants. And they might not look exactly the same, you know, ostensibly, but there's going to be a real similarity to their purpose, unless we are in a different place.
Same person in a different body.
Yeah, exactly.
Time and time again. One of the questions I've asked, which I think is kind of interesting to someone, will say, describe your dad emotionally to me, not physically, emotionally. And then they'll do a description. And then you say, well, describe your mom emotionally, not physically, emotionally. And then the boyfriend, the girlfriend, the husband, the wife, the significant other, whomever it is, you're usually going to find one of those personalities, those emotional personalities, are going to match up. And the problem that they have within the relationship is what they didn't complete with that parent. Mm-hmm. And even if that parent's passed away, that's the battle they have in the relationship that they're in at the moment.
I definitely think that's true, you know, and I remember hearing somewhere that the definition of a happy adulthood is dealing with and resolving your childhood. And I think in a lot of ways that's really true, that if you're picking somebody that doesn't raise your insecurities that you have, or your defense mechanisms that you created in order to survive whatever it was you needed to survive growing up, but yet you pick someone that sort of helps you look at it from a different angle or actually suppresses those anxieties, you're in a lot better shape for happiness. But it's very hard to sort of do that. And what I really like about what you just said in that sort of, that test of thinking about it in that way, is that you are pinpointing people's emotional profiles, and so you could, it will show you that someone might just be someone from your past in a different pair of pants.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. But the key is, Laura, is to know it. If you know it, you get a handle on it. That doesn't mean that life's going to turn completely around for you. But at least look at the signals, those those points of interest, quote unquote proof points, if you will, to really recognize not only if you want to know who you are, look at who you're with.
Oh, I like that a lot. Yeah,
it's true. It's absolutely true. All right, let me ask you this. We're just about starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. LauraDaves.com is my website, and I can be found also on Twitter. My handle is Laura Dave.
Wonderful. Okay, we can buy the books and find out more about you there?
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Hey, Laura, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
Oh, thank you.
Take care. Good night.
You too.
You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you now, some of these days.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Helen Rivas Rose with us, the author of Brave, a memoir of overcoming shyness. As an adult, she worked in several locales and fields, giving private English lessons in Madrid, Spain, teaching school and adult education in Calgary, Alberta, owning and operating a medicinal herb store in Lisbon, Portugal, and later directing her nonprofit alternative artist gallery in Portland, Maine. Shyness affected her every activity. And let us say, hi, Helen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I'm shy.
Could I ask you to speak up a little bit louder, please?
Absolutely. I'm glad you did that. Can you hear me better now?
A little bit, yeah.
Let me do this. Let me amp this thing up. Okay. How about I got a button here? Okay. The magical angels from the network are working on the sound.
Okay.
How's that? Hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, great. Okay. Helen, let's start with this. Let's lay a base of what it is we're going to deal with tonight. The word shyness, what actually is shyness?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, first of all, because for the title of my book, I said A Memoir of Overcoming Shyness, but it isn't shyness. It's severe shyness or chronic shyness. And I figured that if anybody was going to pick up my book, they must have known what I was talking about, because nobody would spend 9 years writing about overcoming a simple form of shyness. So first of all, for people to know that there is something called severe shyness, chronic shyness, that you essentially just don't shed by yourself, and it can hang around until, you know, you really have to be very brave, although that's not always fun to be, to overcome it.
No. As a matter of fact, the area, too, of consideration when we talk about defining shyness, let's say, for instance, that I'm around somebody who's shy. I don't understand it. And I don't know, maybe it's me that's causing it, which it probably isn't. But
no,
the key
no.
is shyness in and of itself is not just for people who are shy. It's for people who are around people who are shy that really don't know how to relate.
Of course. Yes. And yes. I really think it's up to the shy person to overcome it. I mean, it's hard to expect somebody else to speak in such a way so that the shy person feels comfortable. And that's normally not going to happen unless it's in, like, a teacher and a pupil or something like that, and the teacher speaks in a caring way and talks about the problem.
Okay, let's go back with you personally. Let's go all the way back. Your earliest memories of what it was like to be shy. What was it like for you?
Yeah, I was about 2.5, 3 years old, and I went to a place called Tiny Tots, and I just couldn't play with anybody. I sat on the perimeter of the playground where other people were. Every once in a while, an adult will say, "Come over here, Helen, and play." But I didn't do anything. I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to play. So I didn't, and I just waited until it was time to go home. At home, I wasn't shy. I was with my brother and my parents, and I wasn't shy there. So I don't think my parents really knew how shy I was away from home.
No. By the way, the word that comes up for me listening to you is the word called safety. At home, it was safe. You get outside, it's not safe. So you have to hide.
Yes, shyness is rooted in fear. There's no doubt about that. For me, it was not exactly fear or safety. It was just a tantalizing, overwhelming feeling of being secluded, of being isolated, and not being able to connect with other people.
When we talk about not being able to connect with other people, where was the disconnect? Was it within you or what you thought they would experience of you?
No, I think it was very, very largely within myself. I had just had this overwhelming fear, this overwhelming feeling that I didn't know how to communicate, that I suffered from a lack of communication skills.
Now, by the way, where did you finally get the communication skills? Obviously, you're a teacher. But the key is the lack of the communication skills. If it doesn't come from home, it's got to come from somewhere. So skills are learned, but also not using a skill or that's also learned. Now, whatever we do, it's learned behavior, which gives us a response. So in essence,
I just didn't learn. There weren't any young children around my home. My parents were elderly. I did have a brother who was 2 years older, but I didn't get to play with him too much because my mother tended to keep us separate so that we wouldn't fight and upset her. Not that we were great fighters, but we quarreled, as young children do.
Maybe we're coming to something here. Let me tell you what I'm hearing. That you were kept quiet and secluded only because you didn't want to upset your mother. Now, you get out into public. Isn't that the same scenario?
Well, out in the public, I was scared. I wasn't scared at home. I out in the public, I just shut down. I closed my ability to integrate myself with what was going on around me.
Just out of curiosity, do you think in your heart of hearts, if you would not have been shy as a youngster, you would have chosen a different path? You would have been somebody completely different than you are today as regards to your chosen profession?
Oh, of course, yes. It affected everything. I wasn't able to get a job when I graduated from university because I was afraid to work with people. In fact, I went to Spain for 4 years and didn't know what to do. I taught a little bit of private English lessons. I married somebody who I thought who was very effusive. He's Venezuelan, and he made me feel good, but you know, I didn't learn how to communicate. I could with him, of course, but I didn't break out into the open with other people. I think it wasn't until I was working in the nonprofit tax-exempt art gallery, where I worked as a volunteer. And I was the director, so all the artists, all these wonderful creative people had to work with me in order to show their art. And that opened up a whole new path for me. And I saw there were more ways than one to skin a cat, so to speak.
Now, by the way, is it possible that, now, have you overcome it, or is it still there in some form, even though it may not be noticeable for to someone who doesn't know you?
No, I don't feel in the least bit shy, and that's very, very important, because when I had all those jobs, like teaching and being the director, and I pretended not to be shy, but that's the big drawback, because once you get into that rut, you tend to just let life be, and you don't get over it. But so I forced myself by going and doing things in the public, by giving talks at the Unitarian Church and interviewing people about shyness. I forced myself to get out there and do things. And then I wrote for 9 years, taking writers' workshops and talked with other writers. I found out that I was very compatible with writers. So that was a big help for me, too.
Did you by chance study shyness?
Good with.
Did you study shyness?
Not until I was like 58. I picked up Phil Zimbardo's book called Shyness, which was written, I think, in 77. It's probably one of the few books that really, really helped me. And I felt that Phil Zimbardo was the very first person who ever understood me.
Did you find an overarching theme, some kind of commonality in the people that he talked about? Anybody who's shy, if you got 100 shy people together, would you find, if you went to each one of them, to the core of each one of them, if you went to base, would you find commonalities?
We suffer from a lot of pain. It's very, you're very lonely and you're isolated, and you see your friends doing things and you can't do them. You don't have good friends. You're not able to reveal yourself in a personal way. So you really miss out on all those wonderful things in life that help a person to grow. And I noticed in your last segment you talked about the fact you have to love yourself before you can love others. Well, I say in my book that one of the first things I had to do was to learn about shyness, and then I had to learn about myself. Why was I shy? What was my life all about? And I learned that over the 9 years when I was writing about myself. But what? So I say you have to do the opposite of the golden rule. You have to like yourself, know yourself, and like yourself before you can know and like other people.
Oh, sure. I can only give you what I've got. I can't give you anything that I don't have. And if I don't have security and if I don't have love, I can't give it to you.
Yeah, it's very hard. It's very hard. If I don't feel good about myself, it's very hard to receive anything from somebody else. That's true. That's a very good point. Yeah.
And by the way, when you said you were, 58 when it began to start, which says one thing, that it's never too late. I know how cliche that sounds, but if there's somebody out there listening,
it's very, very important. But as I said earlier, a lot of people just hide it. They cover it up. But know that it's a dreadful feeling, and you just really, really, really want to get over it, because then you feel like a brand new person, and the world has become friendly for you, and I have lots of friends, and I know how to give to them, and I know how to receive from them, and I just, my life is totally, totally different. So the important thing is to get rid of every symptom of shyness that you have.
And get a handle on it. Now, by the way, and I know this is going to sound a little ridiculous, but does anybody have classes on shyness? If somebody's shy, where do you go?
Oh, yes. So if you go online, there, I think when I first went online about 10 years ago, there were like 250,000 sites, and now there are about 5 or 10 million. There are lots and lots of people who want to help you. A lot of them, all they do is really try to help you meet a mate, how to talk with somebody of the opposite sex. Which is not really beneficial at all. What you need to do is get at the root of your own shyness and get rid of it.
So, oh, no question
about it. There are, and of course, psychologists nowadays know what it is. I would recommend, like in school, if you were shy, that the teacher take you aside and talk about the different types of people. That some people are naturally outgoing and they know how to play and run around and talk, but other people have to learn how to do that, because not everybody is born with those skills. That would have helped me an awful lot.
Oh, no question about it. And I really believe if they could do something like that. And as a matter of fact, I don't necessarily know if it would be really good to take somebody aside or to talk about it in a group without specifically targeting a person. That way you can hear it from the outside and you don't have to be confronted, quote unquote, and maybe defense out and get frightened about it. But there should be something along those lines realistically in the schools. And I really believe, whatever this word education means anymore, that there are certain traits, there are certain behaviors that should be addressed. And there's a lot of kids who suffer, quote unquote, suffer from shyness and other things of that nature that could be stopped, that could be taken care of.
Yeah. One thing that also I think would have helped me would be do more reading. I didn't read much when I was growing up, so I was, but I think I could have read about, other people who were shy or things like that, and that would have helped me a lot, or even just reading more in general. But let me tell you what they're doing. My grandson is a little bit shy, nothing like the way I was, but when he first went to kindergarten, public school, the teachers and everybody noticed that he was shy. He didn't quite know how to get in line to go into the building. So the teacher said, "Can I take your hand, Noah?" And Noah said, "Oh, yes." And he was very happy to have somebody's hand to go into the school with. And then a week later, and this was after school was beginning in September, and you know how busy teachers are at that time, Noah's parents, his teacher, assistant teacher, special ed teacher, the principal, and you won't believe this, the superintendent, all got together, and for an hour and a half, they plotted out a course of how to deal with Noah's reticence.
How great that is.
Yeah, and so one of the things they did, which was really fantastic, they brought in a special table. The special ed teacher came into the kindergarten classroom and set up a table. There were seven children there, they all worked with a special ed teacher, and nobody knew that this whole table was set up just for Noah. That's kind of like what you were saying earlier, that it would be great if you can help somebody without telling them that they're different, that they're shy or something like that. So and at the end of the year, he was able to talk much more, and he has friends, and he's much, much more comfortable. He's not totally out of it, but, he's only 6 years old. So.
By the way, better you catch him at 6 than 16.
Yes, for sure. They're addressing it. So, I think it's just wonderful that they do that.
Now, by the way, do you think many other schools are doing this at this point?
This school is in Sudbury, Massachusetts, and it's got the third best school district in Massachusetts. And this particular school that Noah goes to was the best within that group. And he only got in because they had a lottery. He picked the lottery, so he's getting all this wonderful attention. So I don't think all schools are like that at all.
All right. Well, it's too bad that they're not. And I really believe that if we come down to it, we would find, Helen, a great percentage of kids today suffer from, and I'm going to use the word again, but suffer from shyness. And it's very hard for parents to really realize what to do about it. They're not trained. And the only thing that they can do is what they've learned. And what they've learned is from their parents and on and on. So I really think it's a great idea.
I really appreciate your interview about it, because I hope some parents will be listening.
Yeah, and I think people like yourself that have been through it, been there, done that, are really the ones to listen to. It's not coming from an academic point of view and out of a book. It's coming from somebody who lived it, who walked the walk, and now is talking that walk.
Yes. And I'm very happy to be able to do it.
Wonderful. Now, do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. I have a website. It's called shynessbook.com. And I have a blog on it, if anybody would like to blog me. And my book is for sale at Amazon. It's also on, the electronic version, Kindle.
Helen, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And I think what you're doing is absolutely great. Go get them.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michael.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay, good night.
Forever. And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toll. All I have are these arms to enfold you.
and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
You'd be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. Now that's all.
Nina Amir back with us, your inspiration to creation coach. She's a seasoned journalist, a book editor, a blogger, a writer, and an author coach and an inspirational speaker. And we're going to talk about where do writers get ideas. And I think that in and of itself is critically important. There is somebody out there listening who has probably all the talent in the world, would be a great writer. And what stops them? Well, I don't know what to write about.
Well, a lot of times they think they don't have good ideas, but they probably have lots and lots of ideas. I have a lot of clients who come to me, and they are amazed when we start working together at the amount of ideas they actually have. They start talking, and before they know it, we have a page full of ideas. They could come to me with one book idea. I had somebody who came to me with one book idea, and before we were done, we had five books they were going to write.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's get personal with you. Go back to when you first started all of this. Was there ever a time you didn't have any ideas for the articles, the essays, the books, the rest of it, where you didn't think you had an idea?
There was a time when I had a hard time coming up with ideas. And I think a lot of that has to do with lack of confidence or feeling like you don't have enough life experience, maybe. But, you know, as time went on, I began to have lots and lots of ideas. But it was a problem for a while.
Oh, no question. And it can be a problem. Where was it that spark hit you and it started to come and it became so strong you ended up doing what you do today?
I think it was later on, you know, maybe after I had my kids and I was more immersed in my life, and I began to have the ability to look at what was happening in my life. And that's what I tell my clients, is look at what's going on in your life. So I began to write articles that may have been, you know, because I'm a journalist, so I began to write articles that would begin with a little, you know, spark or an idea that came from my life. So, for instance, maybe it was that I wanted to know whether what was too much competition, because, for instance, at one point my daughter was ice skating, and it's a very competitive sport, and I wanted to know what's too much competition for a kid at that age. So I proposed that as an article for a magazine, to a parenting magazine, and I used my experience as the jumping-off place for the article, but then I went and I interviewed a bunch of experts, and I did the same on a variety of topics. You know, my kids, we moved a lot. My kids changed schools quite a bit, and I wanted to know what was the effect that was going to have on my kids. So I tell people, you know, look at your life and see what is it that's going on in your life that you have questions about. There's such a high likelihood that other people are struggling with the same issues, which is why I always say, you know, I'm an every woman, like an every man. Most people are the same. Whatever you're struggling with, other people are struggling with, and those are the kind of ideas that are the best, because those are the ones that are going to resonate with someone else. Those are the problems that they're trying to solve, same ones you're trying to solve. And if you have any kind of solution, any solution that will help them, they're going to want to read whatever you've written.
Realistically, and what I've found over the years, that if you want to know what the world is like, look in the mirror because you just said it, the same problems, the same issues, the same challenges, whatever it is, whatever it be, is realistically what you go through, you, me, anybody, maybe not to the degree or something more, you know, more intense than others, but usually it boils down to the same thing. But then you get somebody like yourself, you know, when it comes down to it, you're a journalist, you do blogging, you write books, you work with people and articles, etc. You've got to have ideas coming from more than one source. I mean, you've got to be able to create ideas almost every hour of the hour of your day.
That's true. And, for instance, when you're blogging, that can be tough, at least for some people. And there are some days when I look at the screen and I think, okay, what am I going to write about today? You know, and I might have a moment of panic that there's nothing coming. But if you're passionate about your topic, then you're going to have something to say. And that's what I always tell people. Come up with topics that you're passionate about. If you want to blog, you know, that is something you're going to be writing about for a long time, and you're going to be doing it on a regular basis. So you better pick something you're really passionate about so that you want to write about it all the time and that you're willing to research information so that you have something to write about continuously. But the same with a book. If you're going to write a book, you know, you're going to probably be speaking about it and writing about it for a long time to come. However, if you're writing books, you can change topics. You can write a book on one topic, and then you can switch and write a book about another topic. And that's the great thing about books. The same if you want to write articles and essays. You can write about almost anything. So there's, you know, the whole universe is open to you. And, of course, there's always the news. The news is a huge source of idea generation. I mean, just look out there at what's happening in the world, and you'll have tons of ideas about things to write about, especially if anything out there in the news touches a chord with you. It's probably touching a chord with someone else, and maybe there's something in the news, if you're a business person, maybe there's something that's, you know, that you know about that you could write about. Maybe you have a widget that solves a problem that's in the news, or maybe you've had a similar experience to something happening in the news, and you can write about that. You might be able to write 10 blog posts about something that happened in the news that you've had experience with. So you just have to keep your eyes and ears open.
And I really believe what it comes down to is a fear that most writers, bloggers, writing in any way of any dimension of writing, comes to this point when they start to think, well, if I write, how do I know anybody's going to take me serious? There's going to be any validity. What if they don't care about me? And it's getting over all of those things to realize that if you've got something, the people who you'll trigger emotionally to see that are going to be participating with you. Most people are frightened to death of getting out there and the challenge, and the challenge is not about their book, their blog, their whatever. They're frightened to death that they're going to get judged.
That's definitely true. And that's a big hurdle to get over. I have a woman I'm working with who is a nurse, and she has a book she really feels passionate about writing, and it has to do with breast health, and that's a huge topic. But some of the information she's dealing with, somebody else wrote a book about a while ago, and their book kind of got shoved under the table because nobody wanted to know about it. Not because it wasn't correct, but because there were some big sort of establishment people who just didn't want the information to get out. And so she has a lot of fear about writing her book. And that can be a big hurdle for people, that they're afraid that they're going to get judged. They're afraid that they'll be told they're not good enough. They're afraid that they won't be seen as an expert. And, you know, you really have to sit down and just write from your heart and write with that passion and that inspiration and just know that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. I mean, if you really feel this is your purpose to write whatever it is you want to write, if you feel this is what you're supposed to be doing, it's your mission, and you are passionate about it, then by all means, you should be doing it.
Oh, and by the way, Nina, as far as being judged, you're going to be judged no matter what you do. If you're good, you're bad, you're indifferent, somebody out there is going to judge you. So know that, and it has nothing to do with you. It has to do with their own ability or inability to accept what they are or aren't in their life, and they're going to point their fingers at somebody else. And it can happen whether you were an actor, whether you're a professional, whatever. People are going to judge. And when we get to the realization of it's got nothing to do with you, then all of a sudden the world gets very clear and looks completely different.
That's right. And you know, there was a book that came out, and its title was What You Think About Me. Oh, now I can't remember.
Oh, I know who that was. Wait, What You Think About Me is None of My Business.
That's right. And that's what I always tell people. That's what you have to remember. What you think about me is none of my business. But they're, everyone's so concerned about reviews and all that stuff. And the other thing is that bad publicity is good publicity too. You know, when people say bad things about your book and it gets passed around, it just makes people want to go out and buy it.
I'm going to give you a horrible example of what you just said. Horrible example of what you just said. And it just happened. Casey Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
The people who were running in to get tickets to watch the trial. She just got offered, I wanted $250,000 to go on a television show. And you know, the day she sits on that show and gets interviewed, millions of people are going to be watching. It's just exactly what you just said.
That's right. That's right. So, yeah, any publicity is good publicity. But a lot of this has to do with the fear of being seen. And writers are a weird breed. They so want to tell their story, you know, to sit down and write and to say what they have to say, yet they want to stay behind their computer or, you know, behind their pen and not be seen. And publishing means coming out into the world and being seen and unfolding. You know, we all have this tendency to fold up like an envelope, you know, like a piece of paper, to fold up until we're very small. If you took this piece of paper and you folded and folded and folded until it was tiny. And in order to be a published author, you have to begin to unfold the paper and let people see who you are. And
sure,
that's a really scary thing for people.
And by the way, you know what? The biggest power in the world is to be vulnerable. If I am vulnerable and you know about me, you can't control me. What controls people is very simple. What you think you're hiding from everybody, they know what it is, and they use it to move you in directions. So I think vulnerability and being known, quote unquote, is a very powerful thing. If I have nothing to hide, you've got nothing that you can use against me.
That's right. So you might as well just share it all and get over it, and then you'll be able to go out there and publish your book and be free.
Okay, now comes the big question. And the big question is, how do you know if the idea is good enough to even get published in the first place?
So that's where you really have to put that business hat on again. You know, you have to get past the creative part, and you have to start looking at some of the things we've talked about before. You have to take your idea and think about whether it has a market, you know, whether there's a big enough market for the idea. If it's an article, you're looking at magazines and online publications. If it's a book, you know, you're looking at how many people are out there who might buy it. You're looking at the competition, you know, what else is out there like your book. If it's an article, that's a little different. You know, you have to look at what's been published before that's similar. So you want to look at the magazines and what magazines have published. But if we stick just with books for now, you know, you're looking again at what books are out there, how have they been written, how is yours going to be different and unique, how is it going to stand out from the crowd, and then, you know, does it solve a problem? Does it meet some kind of need? You know, does someone need it? Does it add value? Does it have some sort of emotional resonance with people? So these are all the kinds of things you're looking at to see whether it's a good idea. Because if it doesn't meet someone's need, if it doesn't solve a problem, if it doesn't hit them emotionally somehow, and if it's not unique, and if there isn't anyone out there who's going to buy it, then it's not really a very good idea.
Yeah, absolutely. When you really come down to this, something called a value proposition, what makes you different, what makes your book different than your competition? Why should I buy from you than somebody else? And then there's three areas to look at in that. The features of what you have to offer, the advantages of buying, and then the benefits that you're going to get from it, and then the proof points, that, you know, to prove it out, and that's through stories or anything else. And if you follow that just very simple, basic ruling there, then all of a sudden it works, because then you resonate with all of these different people that you normally wouldn't have resonated with before. And it's really called why am I different than anybody else? And one of the things that I would have to say is that most things that we say today or we create today, it's all derivative. There are hardly any new ideas whatsoever in any venue. But it's the way that you present it that's going to be different. That's where the value is. And I really believe that, and stop me if I'm wrong here, but when it comes to writing, what more could you write? What hasn't been written about yet? Is there anything new on the market?
Very little. I mean, there's some things that are new, but it's exactly like you said. It's all in the approach. And that's where you just have to, the writers have to do their homework. They have to go out there and research what else has been written. And if the market is flooded with books like theirs, it doesn't mean it's a bad idea. I mean, obviously people are writing these books and their publishers are publishing them because somebody's buying them. It just means they have to find a unique angle, something nobody else has done yet.
Which is very hard to do today. There might be a million war stories out there, but it's all the same thing if you break it down to the bare essence of it. A love story. What's different anymore? And I think that's what writers must have a pretty hard time with, because when you really come down to it, to be competitive, if you want that something different about you than someone else out there, it's very hard to find today. And then I would have to venture to guess it would then be in the style of the writing, your compelling way of telling, quote unquote, the story in such a way that somebody actually lives and is involved in the story. That could be the difference between being successful and not being successful as a writer.
Well, sure. So you have to have a unique story. So there's a woman I've been working with on her book proposal, and you know, we have this whole revolution going on in Egypt, and she's written a memoir. Well, there are thousands of memoirs. You know, she's written one. She's Egyptian. She and her sister left Egypt, and they were to be married to elderly men. It was arranged marriage. It's unheard of for two young girls to escape from their families and from that kind of a situation. Well, it's timely right now for her to write such a book. It's a good story. It's, you know, I can't tell you the whole thing, but, you know, these are the kinds of things you have to look at. What's in the news? How can I tie into the news? Is my story unique? Is there a way for me to be totally different and to stand out from the crowd? And yet, at the same time, to touch on to issues that people care about. You know, she's going to touch into women's issues, into issues about freedom, all kinds of things. And that's what you're looking for. A publisher wants something that's going to target all kinds of different markets and be something that's hot.
You know what I think would be a great title for a book? I've been playing with this for the last couple of days. Tell me how many people they wouldn't resonate with. It's, and Radio Susie's staring at me right now. Here it comes. The title of the book should be, What's Wrong With You? Tell me. I relate to that one. Okay, Nina Mir, website we can find you at.
The easiest place to find me is at www.ninaamir.com. That's NINAAMIR.com.
Wonderful. And if we want to get coached, we want to buy books, and everything is right there on the website, right?
It will lead you to the other websites. The best place for my books on writing is at copywritecommunications.com, and that's spelled COPYWRIGHT communications.com. And
Nina. Wonderful. About it. We'll see you next week.
That'd be great. Take care.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that's in the door.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Larry Falls coming up next.
Of her charms, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone. Someday.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Larry Falls with us is an internationally recognized in the field of sexology and erotology. He's presented his work at scientific conferences throughout North America and in Europe, a registered specialist in sexual abuse, trauma, and emotional health. He's a member of the American College of Sexologists and is the author of When Sex Was Religion. Larry, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, I really believe that this is a subject that everybody should truly address. You know, we've got this definition of sex, whatever it is, and it has influenced everything we have done from the day one, whether it be normal sex or erotic sex or whatever the case may be. Behind everything seems to be driven by some form of sexuality.
Absolutely. I think it's really important for people to realize that without sex, nobody would be on this planet. And in the beginning, from ancient times up to the present, the focus has always been on reproduction. Without reproduction, life would not exist on this planet. Not only humans, but plants, animals, and so on. So it's really important to look at that as part of a dynamic for creation and for the universe in general.
Sure. Yeah. When we really come down to it, you've tied basically human sexuality influencing the origin of religion. And when we talk about sexuality, that's not necessarily just someone going to bed with somebody. There's an entire movement around it, an entire definition that most people don't see.
Yes, that's true. And for the ancients, religion was defined as a powerful force that could not be understood by humans. It was so powerful, it was something that you could only imagine. And first of all, when we talk about sexuality is not the same as what people thought it was in the beginning of time. We perceive sexuality today as only between man and woman and for pleasure. Well, in ancient times, it went beyond that because in the beginning, the earth was created by intercourse between the sun and the moon. And life was formed on this planet from the intercourse between the sun and the moon, spreading prolific principles on this planet, giving life to everything on this earth. As a result, it was believed that we can only create life by sexual intercourse. And the celebrations by the kings and queens and celebration of all kinds of situations. It was believed that one must satisfy the gods by having intercourse as a ritual to satisfy the gods in creation and to bring good luck and future prosperity to the world. That's how religion and sexuality is connected.
Well, look at the promise. Look at the base promise in Islam, in the Quran. If you're good, you get 72 virgins or whatever the case may be. So realistically, that's sexuality beyond life.
It is beyond life. And as far as the 72 virgins are concerned, it's very important to understand the concept of what religion is in today's society. It is a myth in a sense that it's symbolic of things that have been lost in history. As a result, we create stories that are symbolic rather than real.
Now, by the way, when we're dealing with this, when we talk about the creation of, I had a friend of mine years and years and years ago who got his doctorate in theology, and he studied many of the different religions, and what he did was some of the study had to do with the Catholic religion and the the non-sexual relationship between the what's the word I want to use? I've lost my word. With the when nuns can't have sex and fathers, the abstinence. There's my word. Okay, the abstinence in and of itself had nothing to do with sin. Originally, the intent was if they're not married, if the fathers and the sisters, those priests aren't married, then the full power of the church was there. The devotion was completely to the church, and it wasn't split with family. That's how that started. And that wasn't easy, obviously, to keep up with along the years as we came into modern times.
Okay. What you explained was more or less the concept of Christianity, the belief in Christianity. Now, prior to the introduction of Christianity, the belief was quite different. For example, when you look at the nuns or the sisters, in the beginning, it was the priestesses and the goddesses, the priestess representing the goddess, and the importance of having intercourse with their followers as a form of initiation and as part of being in contact with the spiritual being. Only after the introduction of Christianity did the concept of sex be considered sin, and of course procreation was acceptable, but again celibacy was the priority in all cases, which is one of the reasons why priests were encouraged to be celibate, and as today priests are supposed to be celibate, and only certain denominations now permit priests to be married.
Yeah, but look what happened with, let's say, the Catholic religion, and this is not all priests, and this is nothing in deference to the Catholic religion. But look at the problem with the priests that have been accused of, molestation, etc. You know, those feelings are going to be inside someone. I don't care what anybody does. And when it comes down to it, why suppress something that's natural and normal and it's there? Why not have it come out in a very healthy way through a marriage? Rhetorically, obviously, the question is.
Yes, absolutely, because when you look at the first of all, it's important to understand what religion is and what human sexuality is. Now, when you look at human sexuality, it's a very important aspect of being a human being. People have intercourse basically primarily for reproduction, the importance of having progeny for once you leave this earth. It was also used for pleasure. And also, more importantly, it adds balance to life. And it's a way to express yourself where otherwise you could never express your feelings. So it's a combination of many factors. It's a very complex issue when you're looking at human sexuality. It adds balance to life.
Oh, no question about it, but I really believe you've hit on a point. It's understanding what sexuality is. And sexuality, again, I'm going to go back to the very beginning of the conversation here. It is not just sex in and of itself. What they've done in the movies obviously has nothing to do with sexuality that is healthy and normal. There's nothing wrong with having sex with someone. But what they've done with it, they put it up for sale.
Yeah, that's very true. It's very dangerous to model yourself after what you see in the movies or, people nowadays look at pornography and all sorts of magazines and things of that nature. It's very dangerous because that's not what sexuality is really about.
No, not at all. And when you let the youngsters, the the 10, 11, 12-year-olds, especially the girls, you know, know that, well, you know, it's okay. They do it in the movies. They do it here. They do it there. And at 14 or 15 years old, when they come home with the baby and their life is completely ruined because now they're not going to be able to grow socially and academically like the other kids that it's their age. Who do you blame for that? And again, rhetorical question. I'm not looking for an answer to that. So sexuality has to do, the definition of sexuality has to do with the existing culture, the present culture at the time.
Absolutely, because it is the culture that dictates how one behaves. And depending on what culture you grow up in, you basically behave according to the way you've been taught. That's why there's such a complex issue and so many problems in today's world, because of the different cultures with different belief systems. That leads to a lot of frustration. But when we talk about sexuality, we're also talking about sexual exploitation. And I think that's what's happening in the media, and a lot of the media today is the exploitation of sexuality, thinking that it's primarily for pleasure and so on and so forth, when in reality one needs to learn the aspects of the importance of sexuality and the spiritual part of sexuality as well.
Larry, for the media, it's all about money. I mean, there's no question that's what it is. If it sells, that's what they're going to do, and they're not going to hold back on it. The problem is it's the youngsters that get hurt when they have a certain ideology that they follow, a certain pathway. This is where the problems start, because when it really comes down to it, you know, let me get political with you for a minute. Go right to the borders today. Everybody's screaming and yelling about somebody coming across the Mexican-American border. Well, it's not just somebody coming over here to get a better life. There's a lot of sex trafficking there, human trafficking that goes on over that border. There's trafficking all over the world. And that in and of itself is part of sexuality, because somebody's going to pay for it. If we wouldn't pay for it, it wouldn't happen. If we wouldn't pay for drugs, it wouldn't happen. So there is a reversible cause and effect to all of this. If there's a responsibility, it lies on everybody on both sides.
This is true. The trafficking is a big issue, and of course it's money that plays a large role in it. The unfortunate thing is that it's not going to stop, no matter what laws may be enacted. It's going to continue until society itself takes greater control over identifying what sexuality is all about. Unfortunately, I think most people don't want to take responsibility, or they're basically wanting immediate pleasure, instant gratification, rather than looking at the consequences of the problem.
Oh, no question about it. Larry, let me ask you this. I pick up When Sex Was Religion, and I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get to walk away with once I have read that book?
Wow. it's quite a powerful book if you're inclined to be somewhat religious, or if you're interested in what happened in our ancient past. I think what we'll look at is basically, or what you'll walk away with, is the fact that women throughout history have been demonized, have been abused, and that religion plays a large role in that. Also, it looks at how we've all been manipulated, and we're still manipulated by those in power to consider what we should be doing sexually. We live in a world of sexual exploitation, and that's precisely what the book is about, looking at history. And you know what? History has not taught us anything in regards to sexuality, because we still have sexual exploitation, we still have power struggles in social in our society, and we need to slow down and take a look and study history and look at where we're going, where we came from, and where we are going. We need to seriously consider to, you know, look at ourselves and think about, what do we want our children to have in the future? Do we follow the same path as we have and today we still are, or do we want to look at a stronger ethical base and go from there?
Larry, we've got a couple of minutes to go, but we're going to give you the magic wand. And the magic wand, we now make you King of America. You can do anything you want to do anytime, anywhere, whatever you say people have to do. With you in control, with you at the wheel, how do you fix the problem? What would you do?
Well, I think the laws need to be overhauled in a sense that, you know, for example, children. I have serious problems with people who manipulate and abuse children. I think there needs to be stiffer laws in regards to that, and stiffer laws in regards to sexual abuse of all sorts. And above all, I think we need to give women more equality in politics and in general, work-wise. They've been oppressed most of their lives, and I think we need to deal with that.
Okay, but the oppression is not quite what it was years behind. Still, there's maybe some going on, but not to the degree that it was. You see, you know, the Hillary Clinton. Nobody suppresses her. She's a female. And, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And I think today we're seeing more and more women in power positions and in areas where they can have an effect. So, in essence, what we had is not quite what we have. Now, I'm not wearing blinders and saying that there's no discrimination anywhere, anyhow. That's not necessarily true, and I got that. But at the same time, we are a lot closer to whatever that end result, that end game is, than we were 10, 15 years ago.
Yes, we are a lot closer, but we still have a long way to go. We still have to learn how to get along with each other. We still need to look at the opposite sex in an equal manner. We need to change attitudes, especially males' attitudes toward women. Because there's still an awful lot going on, especially the everyday woman, not necessarily all the professional women. Yeah, they're doing okay. They have no, you know, they don't have very many issues in regards to careers and so on and so forth. But still, there are quite a large number who are in the low income bracket and seem not to be able to get ahead. We need to consider that. We need to look at that.
Okay, let me ask you this. We're just about out of time. Is there a website we can find you at?
Yes. You can view my website at www.whensexwasreligion.net.
Wonderful. Hey, Larry Falls, thank you so much for joining us, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me, and have a wonderful evening.
You too. Good night.
Good night.
Said some of these days I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Gray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And then we heard a beep. We heard some kind of boop over there. We've got noise coming from outer space. It's time to get the tinfoil on. Okay. Ralph Migliosi was with us. Migliosi is with us. He's been in the financial industry for 30 years. Now he's president of First Choice Financial, and he's got he's the weekly radio host of Mortgage Magazine on KNCO in Grass Valley, California. He is the author of, Collateral Damage, Life as a Mortgage Broker. Ralph, I welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, by the way, thank you so much for being here. When we talk about collateral damage, life as a mortgage broker, you guys really got hit in the last couple of years. Will you ever get your way out of it? I mean, it was a strong hit, and a lot of it was blamed on people that shouldn't have been blamed on, because I'm going to use this reversible cause and effect. People took mortgages that they weren't supposed to take, that they knew they couldn't afford, and there were certain people that let them have it, knowing what the consequence was. Is there a survival for you guys?
For the mortgage broker, probably not. It's a mortal wound. Congress, you know, there really wasn't many people to blame from Congress's point of view, and so mortgage brokers became you know, the target, and they felt that they could pile on, and someone needed to be the scapegoat for this. So, as you know, it wasn't really no. There's been no legislation of any merit that was passed against real estate agents, and there was a ton of legislation, literally, that turned the industry upside down. That has been a devastating effect not only for mortgage brokers but for the consumer. It has completely limited their choices and completely devastated values. Just the laws that they passed.
Ralph, almost today, how do you buy a house? And when I say how do you buy a house, you've got to have such golden credit to be able to get a mortgage today. And in addition to that, with the economy the way it is right now, people may have the credit, but they may not have the money to do it. And is buying a house today truly the best thing to do? I've known so many people now that have let their property go. You know, it was worth $500,000 when they bought it. Now it's worth $200,000, $175,000, and there's no way that they could ever recapture. And they're spending, you know, $2,000-$3,000 a month for the mortgage payment, and they're paying in to nothing.
Well, keep in mind that there's been a reset of values. When I say reset, you know, the devastation that's taken place in the housing market due to the subprime crisis, and now due to the massive strategic foreclosure wave, which is people walking away from their properties that are healthy, can make their payments, they're not in any financial distress. That reset in values makes property values and buying property certainly very attractive right now. So more attractive than renting? Probably not. There are values, there are houses that are at least 50%, in some cases, you know, 60% less than they were, you know, in 2007.
Sure.
And with interest rates, you know, below 5%, if you can qualify for a mortgage, you know, the double whammy of houses cut in half and interest rates in the fours is going to, you know, make your payments ridiculously low. So, I mean, you could talk about, you can actually get a payment on a, you know, $150,000 mortgage below $700.
But let me ask you this, and I think this is critically important in today's world, and this has got to do with subject matter tonight. When we're dealing with the average professional, whatever field it is, it's like going to the doctor's office. You have no idea what medicine is, so you go in there and the doctor says, okay, you got this and take this medicine, and you're afraid to say no. You go to who you think is a professional, let's say a real estate professional salesperson. They're supposed to know everything. You don't know anything, and you don't know where to look and how to check it up and validate what it is that you're getting. How do you tell who's for real and who's not? And when I say who's not, somebody could have a license, but how do you tell who is going to do the best for you?
Well, that's a very good question. As you know, medicine as well as loans and financial matters, anything that is abstract is very hard to pin down. You can't go to a showroom and look at an interest rate. And so you have to trust people in these fields, and unfortunately there are a lot of people that in financial fields and in real estate especially that are, you know, you kind of keep in mind they're still salesmen. They're paid on a commission.
Sure.
And so here's how you know whether you're working with a good salesman or a bad salesman. First of all, a good salesman will tell you, when you tell him what you want, he will find out if that's what you need. A good salesman will actually not give you what you want. He will risk losing the sale by saying that is not, I understand that's what you want, but he'll ask you some very specific questions about your needs, how long you're going to be in the property, what are your goals, what are you trying to do. So any kind of good salesman is going to take an inventory of what your goals are and make sure that you're getting what you need and not what you want. And a good salesman will actually say, you know what, if you're going to do that, they're bound by real estate laws, a fiduciary relationship, to actually tell you not to do something that they believe is not in your best interest. So, number one, a good salesman will give you what you need and not what you want and risk losing the sale over it, not chasing the commission. The other thing that bad salesmen do is to try and get you to say yes. They use sales techniques to get you just to say yes to persuade you to buy. And that is not a technique that a good salesman uses. A good salesman does not convince people to buy. People are already convinced to buy before they meet you. They just want to find the person that's going to take them home to the closing table with the least amount of pain. So a good salesman understands that people are already ready to buy before they meet you. You don't convince people to buy things they don't need or want. So that's the second thing that a good salesman does. The third thing that a salesman does, that bad salesman does, is that they use techniques to get you to close. A sales technique, they'll use a special of today that you have to buy today, that you're going to lose out on some deal. They'll give you a special two-for-one off when you're really not getting any particular deal. If a deal's a good deal, it's going to be there tomorrow. It's going to be there next week. We don't need techniques and selling people things based upon some kind of mousetrap method. So those are the three things I would say that if you see that in a salesman, you should run as far away and as fast as you can.
Now, by the way, you said a very important word. You said the word fiduciary, which, you know, there's trust there. If there is a fiduciary obligation, if that's a legal obligation, and you said something else up front, that they had no consequence, shouldn't there be consequence for somebody bringing you into a situation or condition that the law said that they can't?
Well, there are consequences. They decided not to enforce the law. Every real estate agent that put a person into the kind of a home knows something about their financial matters because they have to get a letter from a loan agent and they have to discuss the financial situation of that particular purchaser before they actually present the offer.
Sure.
And there were people who literally didn't have jobs, literally. They were literally making as half as much as they were going to pay in their house payment, and many agents knew that. And so the fiduciary responsibility, and for those of you who don't know what that is, a fiduciary responsibility is what a trustee has to a trust. And it's the highest level of responsibility you have. In every business, you know, you only have to have the threshold is fair and honest dealing. Real estate far exceeds that. If somebody's going to do something that you believe will harm them, you have to warn them not to do it. And if they go to do it anyway, you have to get them to sign something that says, I've been told that this will harm me. That's a fiduciary responsibility, and that was rarely used during the subprime crisis. And all those people that did that should have been prosecuted. The law does prosecute them to the highest level of the law.
Sure, but there was another area of consideration. We don't have to follow it all the way, but the leveraging and the packaging, you know, from the banks and so on and so forth, and all of those things that happen with those mortgages, because when you come down to it, I buy a house, who's going to profit? Somebody who is buying some kind of stock, quote unquote. So in essence, it went more than just that person buying the home. The banks had something to do with this, and all those people all the way up the ladder. Because when you package, then you repackage, then you repackage, and then there's this great number on it that was supposed to be worth, and you bought stock, you bought shares in it, and when it crashed, that multi-billion-dollar something that you bought into was only worth. It was far more than just the real estate person getting
a
commission.
No, it was a whole chain of people. I mean, we're not suggesting that the homeowner or the person who was buying was not equally responsible.
Yeah.
People are adults, and a lot of people bought because of the greed of equity they thought they were going to get. They were sold in this marketplace that your house is going to increase 20% by next year. So it wasn't an issue of whether they could make the payment. What was sold by real estate agents and loan agents to a borrower was, can you hang on for a year until you can make $100,000 on your house? That's what the selling point was. And so people felt confident that putting people into homes on that basis. Keep in mind that these loans prior to 2004 were unheard of. You know, Wall Street demanded more real estate because we were already, you know, I mean, it was tepid hot, the real estate market, and there was literally no more loans to be made. Everyone that could get into a house that could qualify was in one. So someone said, you know, gosh, we want more of this real estate. Can you give us more? And so they created loans for the unqualified borrower. Now, it wasn't the banks that did that. It wasn't your commercial bank. It wasn't Bank of America. It wasn't Washington Mutual that created these types of loans. These loans were created by mortgage bankers. Mortgage bankers are not federal depositories. They do not have chickens and savings accounts. They're literally just an entity that is licensed by the state that gets a warehouse line. And a warehouse line of credit allows you to be a lender, period. When you get a warehouse line of credit of, say, $50 million, you can begin lending right away. Mortgage bankers did that, and what they did that hadn't happened before was they created what was called collateralized mortgage obligations, which have been around, but they created some that were extremely risky. Now, collateralized mortgage obligations that are crap or are really bad, no one would buy unless they felt there was some incentive to buy them. So you have to write a collateralized mortgage obligation so that Wall Street will find investors to buy it. And for the first time in history, people wrote these what these were going to entail, including no down payments, bad credit, and no ability to make the payment, stated income, which is no proof of your ability to make your payment back. And because it was tied to real estate, a lot of people didn't read them. So people were going and saying that these things are tied to real estate. They're going to be great. Real estate's going crazy. And even if these loans go bad, heck, property's going to appreciate 20% next year. We may catch a cold, but we're not going to die. And that's way. What's that?
Oh, I said absolutely. I was just going to jump in with that. It's always been cyclical. The market goes down, the real estate market, it comes back up again. 1985, I bought 10 acres, and I built a house on it in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I think the whole thing cost us about $110,000.
There you go.
Yeah, 91, I think it was. No. Maybe it was the early part of the late 80s. We sold the house for $185,000 worth of property, and a year or two after that, the bottom dropped out. I mean, that thing wasn't worth $110,000 again, and the people who bought it lost, and then they probably sold it after that. But the point of contention is I bet that property before this last crash was worth at least $250,000 because the market would gain, it would bottom out, it would come back, it would bottom out, and this is the way the market's been. This time, you've got to add in everything that you just said as a factor, and the market is not going to do what the market did or has been doing.
No, it did. Well, what happened was the bubble was created by all of these people that came in and bought homes who created an even hotter market that couldn't qualify. What nobody considered is that there would be a 50% default rate 2 years later.
Yeah.
The market was already faltering by April of 2007 before the subprime crisis was even announced. It was already going down 2 to 3% nationally, and the credit rating companies, to cover their behinds, their heads were buried in the sand. They were crossing their fingers, hoping that these credit ratings that they gave AAA would not be discovered. When there was a big hole in the dam and it started to drain, they came out and said, oh, we're going to downgrade $250 billion worth of loans, and that caused a cataclysmic problem in the market. The market blinked, and then they came back and announced more downgradings, and then the whole thing just collapsed.
Now, by the way, in the old days, when there was a place whereby the market was at the bottom, you knew it was going to come back up, that was always, now it's time to buy, now it's time to buy. Now, the market is the way the market is. There's a lot of homes that are just sitting there. The bank ended up owning them. But this is not the time to buy.
I agree.
If you could even buy it in the first place.
Well, it's not time to buy if you're looking for the lows. It's an excellent time to buy if you're looking for a piece of real estate that you can afford. But if you're looking for the absolute lows and you don't want to take an additional hit after you buy, then this would not be the time. And I'm one of the few real estate people saying that. Now, how do I know that? Am I just guessing? The reason I know that is because we are not through the height of the foreclosure problem. Let me say that again. We are not through the height of the foreclosure problem. The highest point of foreclosures were at the end of 2007. We're going to experience even more foreclosures by the end of 2011 because there's still some funny loans out there that haven't blown up yet. And so we're going to experience even more. That's one reason there's going to be more inventory. The second reason is the shadow inventory. There's still over 1 million properties out there that are delinquent over 3 months that have not even have a notice of default filed against them. And we call that shadow inventory, properties that will go into default that we are not even aware that are in default because lenders are refusing to file a notice of defaults against those properties. The number one thing that determines demand in this country is housing starts. And usually housing starts in a hot market are around 1 million. In a weak market, they're around 800,000 per year or so, per month, excuse me. and in a really weak market, they're right around 700,000. We are below 500,000 in housing starts, which tells us that values are going to continue to decline.
You know, for the life of me, I have no idea how banks stayed and made money. And the reason I'm saying that is there were people that owned property that hadn't paid any mortgages for 18 months, for 2 years. And from what I understand, and I talked to a few people that were in the middle of it, the note would be sold, then we'd be sold to somebody else, and then we'd be sold to somebody else, and nobody knew who owned the note, and nobody knew who to contact to get any information out of, and therefore they sat in their property and didn't pay.
That's one reason, but the main reason that shadow inventory exists is because as soon as a lender files a notice of default against that property, they have to take the loan amount and put it in reserve. And that is something banks do not want to do. The number one reason that the Fed seizes banks is because of lack of reserves. So if you have to keep putting $300,000 and $400,000 and $500,000 aside that there's no longer liquidity for you because you have a non-performing asset, that's a very bad thing for a bank. And so that tells us that our banking system is still in trouble. If banks are unwilling to file notice of default, to set apart reserves and allow people to live in their homes for 1 to 2 years, that's a big sign of a banking crisis.
I hear you loud and clear. We're just about running out of time. Do you have a website we can find you and the book at?
Yeah. To get deals and downloads, the best place to go for the download of the book, the cheapest place, is brokerbust.com, B-R-O-K-E-R, bust.com. But it's also available at, you know, Borders. It's available at Amazon and all the major places where you buy books online. But brokerbust.com is going to give you the best combination deals on my book. And I have another book called The Foreclosure Game, too.
Great. Ralph Migliozzi, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. And there's more people who need to hear what you have to say.
Well, thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Thank you.
All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all. A dream lover will come my way, a girl to hold in my arms, and know the magic of her charms, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone. Where are you with a love oh so true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old, because I want a girl.
I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Bob Grady with us. He's the author of The Spur and the Sash. It's a novel, a true story of love, passion, and betrayal in the aftermath of the American Civil War. And he's a graduate of DePaul University and the Emory School of Business. He's been on the faculty of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Carroll College and Marquette University, syndicated columnist and frequent contributor to magazines. He's the author of the best-selling Naked Marketing, The Bare Essentials, and several other books on marketing and strategic planning. And let us say, Rob, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, thanks very much.
Hey, thank you so much for being here. You know, I got to tell you, before we get into this, it's got to be accurate because I was there.
You were at the Civil War. Oh, good for you. And which side were you on?
I was on the North.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. At least you were the winners.
Okay, yeah. At least I remember the whole thing. By the way, the novel in and of itself, being a businessman, being a business professional, what spurred you to the spur and the sash?
A labor of love. It really came about as a result of inheriting a couple of artifacts, a spur and a sash. And then when I asked my father to tell me the story of them, I mean, they're kind of unusual artifacts. When he handed them to me as he was moving to Florida, I said, where did you get these and what are they? And he started to tell my siblings and me the story. And, you know, my father tells a lot of boring stories. This wasn't one of them. All of my siblings and I sat there in rapt attention and listened to the story and went, holy cow, Dad, you ought to write a book. And, of course, he looked at me, since I was the writer in the family, and said, no, Rob, you write the book. Hmm. So I kind of, it sort of fell to me by default.
Now, by the way, the book in and of itself, when we look at history, how much history was in that spur and in that sash? They had to be still alive after all of those years to be able to develop a story out of them.
It's very interesting. As I started doing the research, I discovered that the spur came from a fellow named Nathan Bedford Forrest. Now, many people would know that he was a Confederate general, a very successful Confederate general, but not as many people know that he was also the very first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. And the fact that my great-great-grandfather, a Yankee, had this spur from this Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, I thought, there's got to be a story there. So I began to do the research, and I discovered how he came to have that. And then the sash actually came from the woman that he fell in love with. My great-great-grandfather was wounded at one of the last battles of the Civil War at Nashville, and he was left behind to recuperate on a southern plantation where he fell in love with this southern belle. And she's the one who gave him the sash, her sash. So you're right, there's an awful lot of history in those two little artifacts, and once I dug into it and discovered some of those things, the story almost wrote itself.
Now, by the way, when you take the bits and pieces of the story and you fast forward to today, are we any different today? I mean, I know the culture is different. I know people think differently. And it was a much more simple world during the Civil War, and we were simpler people. We didn't have the madness of media, et cetera, that we're bombarded with today. But if you take the guts, the core of the message, did it live through all of those years to today?
I believe so. A lot of folks talk about the contentiousness of politics today, having 24/7 media and whatnot, and the argumentation or argumentative attitude that occurs in Congress, and of course here in Wisconsin, what happened in Madison with Governor Walker and the protests and whatnot. But on the other hand, you don't see people shooting at each other when it's all over. Most of it is handled in a fairly dignified manner. I say most. And I'm sure you and I could think of a number of cases where that may not be the case, but at least no one is actually shooting at each other. So in that regard, we can at least say that we're willing to talk about our problems. Back then, they were so severe and so divided that the nation literally could not be held together. And they were torn apart. And sometimes, as I'm sure you've heard the cliches in the past, brother against brother and fathers against sons and aunts against uncles against cousins and whatnot. It was just family against family. It was just a terrible situation where more American men died in that war than Vietnam, Korea, World Wars I and II combined. Over 625,000 American men died in that war. We don't have those kinds of problems today, fortunately.
Well, I want to tie something into it. Let's talk about, and I want to stay on subject, spur in the sash, but I want to bring naked marketing into this, the bare essential. If you took the process of marketing today, what it takes to put a product, a service, or something out there, and you went back, you applied it to the ideology of both sides, do you think that there might have been a different turnout? Because it's a process, it's a way to think, and it's a behavior.
Wow, Michael, that's a very interesting question. Certainly the kinds of spin doctors we have today could have been very, very helpful at that time. The way in which the media, I don't want to call it the media is manipulated or are manipulated, but certainly they are helped along in terms of shaping stories or shaping particularly politicians. Had some of the politicians, Buchanan for sure, and certainly Lincoln and Andrew Johnson, his successor, had they had better, call them spin doctors, that and some of the principles in Naked Marketing had been applied with the way in which that was they were packaged and their platforms were packaged. The hope is maybe we could have avoided those kinds of things, but they certainly didn't have the sophistication that we have today. And one of the issues that they didn't have was the mass media that we have today. The telegraph was their most dependable form of communication, and unfortunately during the war in particular, that was very undependable because both sides were cutting wires left and right. I don't know what the answer to that one is, Michael. That's a question that we would have to ponder. It's one of those what if.
Yeah, sure. And it's something else that I'm looking here at your press release, and the spur in the sash deals with the issue of 6 million freedmen at the end of the Civil War and major problems caused by the sudden freedom. You know, we have something called a recidivism rate in our prisons today. Recidivism is, you know, somebody's in there, they get out, they do something wrong again, they get thrown back in jail. And there is a high rate. And one of the reasons for that high rate is once somebody gets in jail and they stay there long enough, they're fed, they're taken care of, they got a place to live, and they don't have to worry about the normal things that somebody does to survive in an economy. And I would venture
to
guess.
Sounds like a great retirement plan, doesn't it?
I'm joining. Okay. But when it really when it comes
I think
down,
it sounds like a terrific retirement program.
But it's the same problem that the freedmen got at the end of the Civil War.
Michael, I'm going to have to differ with you there. The problems they had at the end of the Civil War were far greater. They, by law, had not been allowed to learn how to read.
Yes.
So here were all of these 6.2 million freedmen wandering around trying to find lost family members or family members sold off years before. But because of the law and the way that they'd been treated beforehand, they had no way to read road signs. They didn't know north from south, from east from west. They couldn't find anything or anybody. They also were thrown off of their plantations, so they were left without homes, no education, no way to make a living, no way to feed themselves. Their only idea of freedom was to steal anything that had been denied them as slaves.
Sure.
I don't think we can make that kind of a parallel with recidivism
let me tie it to this, Rob. That
sure.
And I'm not and being right doesn't mean anything to me. I'm looking at this and I'm thinking about it. That it might have been better off being a slave because you get thrown out there into this world where there's nowhere to eat, there's nowhere to live, you can't raise your family, and every place that you move is you're up against a brick wall. And there's where the parallel that I was making. All of a sudden, they got thrown into
the world. I understand.
Yeah, that they weren't ready
for. And you're right. And many of those slaves did remain on their plantations. And in my book, they're some of the main characters were slaves or former slaves, rather, that decided to stay with that plantation. And that's you're absolutely right about that. It was the obviously the lesser of the evils. I mean, but in many cases, they didn't have a choice. There was no one left on the plantation. The plantations had been abandoned. The folks had all gone off to war and been killed. There was no one to take care of them, if you will. So it'd be like having a prison with no guards, no warden, and the cell block has been thrown open. If you decide to stay, that's fine, but you're still going to be in the same position. You have no way to feed yourself. You have no way to earn a living. And you still can't read.
Now, let me ask you this. Rob, I picked the book up. I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get out of that book that I didn't have before? And there's got to be the essence, the core of something that I can look at and see myself in.
It's very much a Romeo and Juliet story. The primary conflict here is the Yankee that's thrown into the South and left to recuperate on a southern plantation where he is reviled by his neighbors. He desires to remain in Tennessee because he's fallen in love with this southern belle who wants to remain on her family's farm. And the bottom line is there is so much hate and so much recrimination following the end of the Civil War. Every fire, every stolen sheep, somebody wants to know where he was. And with that kind of attitude and that kind of hatred that remained after the war was over, particularly while the wounds were still healing, it made it very, very difficult. Conflict was inevitable. We still see it today, 150 years after the end of the Civil War. You and I both know, traveling throughout the South, if we're speaking with a northern accent, we're labeled as Yankees. There's no question, and we're still labeled as Yankees. Unlike whereas a southerner comes north, we don't immediately refer to him or her as a rebel. I think it's a very, very different state of mind when you are the conqueror than when you are the conquered. It's like a child who tries to run away from home, and the parent goes and finds that child and drags him back home, kicking and screaming. The parent is glad to have the child return, but the child will always resent it. And 150 years later, I think Southerners still resent it.
Oh, by the way, no question about it. When I first saw that, and when I say I saw it, I was brought up in Los Angeles. And in Los Angeles, in the year that I was brought up, that's when you asked me originally what side was I on, I couldn't remember. But I was brought up in Los Angeles.
Well, were you from North Los Angeles or South Los Angeles?
South Los Angeles, actually. As a matter of fact, I was brought up in, I went to high school, junior high school, 1955 to 1960. So I was brought up in a completely different era. Yeah, there was prejudice, but we didn't see it that much as we heard about it. Now, my family and I in the mid-60s drove from California to Florida, and then when we got into Georgia and really deep into the South, we saw the bathrooms, we saw the individual water fountains, and we saw everything that we had heard about. So unless you lived it, unless you were there, you'll never get a real feel about what somebody has got a problem with. Now, the key here and the key then is the same thing. How do you move through it? That's really the question.
I agree, Michael. I think that that's absolutely the question. I don't know what the answer is. I think there's always going to be a kernel of that resentment and hatred that remains, particularly when you are the conquered. I think that's just basic human nature. And it comes out very dramatically in The Spur and the Sash as well. The book deals with that repeatedly because of the type of recriminations that were felt by my great-great-grandfather, the Yankee that stuck in the middle of all of this. He felt it dramatically from not only the neighbors and people that were friends of the plantation owner where he was staying, but also the folks who went on to found the Ku Klux Klan, which was all founded right there in Middle Tennessee, not very far from where that plantation was located.
Sure. Now, by the way, and when I really got an experience of it, right after high school, I went into the service. I'm standing tall in Marine Corps boot camp in San Diego, and I buddied up with somebody, like guys buddy up together. And most of the guys that I buddied up with were from Texas. One of them in particular was a close friend. We became close friends. And I remember the first time it happened, we went to chow, and afterwards we came back. And in those days, I smoked. We're having a cigarette, and he was quiet. And I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "Nothing." I said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "If my daddy knew that I sat down and had dinner with the N-word, he said he'd kill me." And that was the first time that I truly saw what it was like. He was born with it. It was inbred with him. And that's what his life was like.
It's a learned behavior. We aren't born prejudiced. There's no question that that's a learned behavior. But I also think it's so firmly ingrained in some cultures that it generations later, obviously, it still hasn't waned completely. We're going to have that. I lived in Atlanta for a number of years and saw it dramatically. I was a Yankee, and I just didn't fit in, and the prejudice that existed around me was kept quiet, and it was not polite to talk about, but it certainly existed, and you and I'm sure, see it all the time, and even though in polite company we don't talk about it, right, it exists, and it's very difficult to get past.
Yeah, no question about it. Robert, just about out of time now. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. There are an awful lot of pictures, unpublished pictures of that era, of the Civil War era. If you're interested in such things, you can go to the website. There is a section on the website that includes discussion questions for your book clubs if you're interested in that. The website's address is the same as the book title, The Spur and the Sash. So it's all the words spelled out, thespurandthesash.com.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for being here. You know, I'm right outside the Milwaukee area myself. If you yelled, we would have probably heard you.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I'm in Mequon.
Oh, you are? I didn't know that. I'm down on the south side in Franklin.
Ah, okay. So we're neighbors. Anyways,
we are neighbors.
Yeah. Hey, and thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Michael Ray, thank you very much. I do appreciate your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care.
Good night. Have a good evening.
The music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door. As they say in this bit, that's all there is. There isn't any more.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain